Mr. Nick McBee Jr. will present arguments for the petitioner.
Your Honor, I have a list of supplemental cases, no briefing or anything, that I may submit to the court for the convenience of the court.
You may do so.
Just hand them to Marcy.
You have one for opposing counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, I have one for you.
May I please call?
You may proceed.
I represent Dorothy and John Higginbotham, who brought a claim for payment of medical expenses against the two insurance companies that are the two insurance companies in this case under the DTPA and the insurance code for an for a hospitalization of Dorothy Higginbotham in March of 1984. In April of 85, they denied coverage. After considerable correspondence and discussion, suit was filed in March of 1986 and service was effective. After some further correspondence, default judgment was taken in January of 1987. At that hearing, the trial court found that service, that the return of service reflecting that it had been served on the registered agent, conferred jurisdiction on the trial court. At the motion for new trial, the defendants, the insurance companies, both brought a motion for new trial on one sole ground, and that is that it was a mistake or inadvertence under crack. Nothing was raised, nothing whatsoever was raised about a jurisdictional issue, much less that 12:01 minute afternoon was not business hours. But at the hearing, there was testimony that Joyce Brown was not the registered agent. The jurisdictional issue, if it could be considered raised, was first brought to the light of the court in a brief that's not brought forward in the record, that the court lacked jurisdiction. Nonetheless, in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, Judge Shatman addressed the issue and said it brought into question the jurisdiction and found that the defendants were both properly served under the former 3.64 of the insurance code, which said a domestic insurance company may be served with service of process at the home office during business hours. That finding of fact was not questioned on appeal. The Court of Appeals first raised the issue and has reversed this case on one point, that there is not proof in the record that a mid-afternoon of a weekday in the middle of the week was business hours. That's the sole issue that brings us here. Now, obviously, you gentlemen have taken your time to just worry about whether 12:01 in the afternoon is business hours. You're busy and must probably have in mind much greater jurisdictional issues concerning the jurisprudence of the state of Texas. And so I try to analyze this in a broader scope, since you have the responsibility of guiding the courts in this state on the very important issue of how they administer their jurisdiction. I need to break down into two segments. Subject matter jurisdiction, which is held to a very high standard, not involved here at all. And personal jurisdiction, which is held to a very high standard as well, but not so high, and is judged on due process, on a matter of fundamental fairness. And that breaks down into several subpoints, and I, to help keep it straight for me, have tried to break it down in this crude chart, and starting out with the question, with the type of issue that we have here, is hyper-technicality needed? Is that something that's needed for the administration of justice in this state, or when is it needed, if it may be needed? Now, we look at the law in two areas. The letter of
Are you saying that if
we apply hyper-technicality that you lose?
You can apply hyper-technicality on the issue of preservation of error and we win. And I'll come back to that. But if you apply hyper-technicality and say that there has to be specific proof in the record that beyond what there is, and I think there's adequate proof, that they came into the office and served it, and that... But the
only problem we're up here on, you say, is whether 12:01 o'clock p.m. is during business hours.
That's
the judge's finding that Joyce Brown was a proper agent is supported by some evidence.
She's not an agent. She's not an agent. So the service rests on whether or not it was served during business hours at the home office.
That's okay.
The home office. And the only question is whether there was proof that 12 mid-afternoon was business hours. That's the basis that the court of appeals refers to.
Right, okay. And what I'm saying is, are you saying that under a hypothetical, under a hyper-technical interpretation of the cases that we have in Texas, that you would lose them?
Yes. I want to show the court how this court hasn't interpreted its own cases hyper-technically as the Court of Appeals, and that if it does, it's out of step with the restatement of the law of most of the country, and it ended on to be cleaned up without a major change.
But you're saying that the Court of Appeals seized upon this when it was not even an issue raised or...
Yes, sir. Precisely. And it does injustice to Rule 324, Rule 52, Rule 81, and there's plenty of safeguards, plenty of opportunities to question and default judgment, and they could have availed themselves. And I'll get down through the analysis, and hopefully it'll be more clear. Well, the letter of the law that that's applied a lot of times to the administration of justice and for judicial efficiency. It doesn't apply here because the strict hyper-technicality is what brought it here. It made it more complicated. So on this issue, it's not applicable here. Now we go to the constitutional issue, the jurisdiction, personal, due process, fairness. Now the restatement of judgments, and this court's in step with the restatement of judgments, except with rule with section 3, the issue that we're confronting here, and possibly section number 10. But the restatement of judgment breaks down the analysis, or points out that the analysis first breaks down into notice and territorial jurisdiction over the person. We're not talking about territorial jurisdiction over the person here, because both companies were served in their home county. That's the hierarchy. And the restatement points out in section 10, which deals with the contesting jurisdiction, that the courts, by considering the two of these together, that is territorial jurisdiction and notice, has tended to trivialize the higher constitutional question, and grossly magnify the notice question in some instances, and I submit that the one we have here is one of those. But territorial jurisdiction we're not concerned with here. We go to notice. Section 2 of the restatement deals with what is adequate notice. Well, adequate notice is something that is official in tenor and notified by actual notice, or is reasonably calculated to lead to actual notice, which is constructive notice. The Section 3, which I feel that the Court of Appeals is in conflict with, says actual an irregularity in actual notice in content or manner does not render a judgment inadequate. Notice is primary.
And is this Section 3 limited to default judgments, or is this general principles for all judgments?
It's general principles, but it specifically addresses default judgments as well.
But you do agree that Texas has always made a very strong distinction. I mean, it doesn't matter how bad the notice is. Once you come into court, you're in court, and we forget about it. Notice takes on it has no significance whatsoever once the issue has been joined.
Precisely. And once somebody appears, you don't worry about technicalities. Once somebody waives service, you don't worry about technicality. When somebody's contested, they're consented to service, you don't worry about technicalities. And my point is, once somebody's got actual notice, and in this case, they've admitted it. Which is much the same as consenting, really, to service or waiving citation. And now that they've admitted it in the pleading, they've admitted it in their affidavits in the motion for new trial, and they've admitted it in testimony at the hearing.
What did they admit?
They admitted that they received the notice, that they had actual notice. And on the issue of whether or not the minute afternoon is business hours, that's never been addressed, so there's nothing one way or the other on that.
Do you have cases about judicial notice, which is now recognized by our rules of evidence, on whether or not a trial judge can and should take judicial notice of when regular business hours are and whether this is a holiday, so on and so forth?
I briefed that, not heavily, but I think this falls within what the judge clearly could have decided. Plus, he had the fact that it was the office. The lady wasn't home. She was at the office.
But I mean, judicial notice applies all the way up the chain.
Yes.
It's not just a judgment. It can go to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court as well.
Certainly not. Any of you from Fort Worth, and I don't know how narrow that should be construed, whether it's statewide, whether it's the city, or whether it's a particular company. And that's a hard issue that I haven't attempted to address here, but I think there are broader things that letting the court decide that as a factual issue, I submit, is the way to handle it rather than this court taking judicial notice, or the Court of Appeals, or whatever, that it's a factual issue that, if properly raised, can easily be confronted at the trial court. And in fact, what? I mean, the judge didn't even need evidence. I submit that it was so clear in this case. But under Rule 118, we could have amended service, and we've got an affidavit that we've attached as an appendix here. And in other cases, this is an employer's insurance case, which is on the list there. No, it isn't on there. So I need to get you to cite that. It's cited in McKenna. McKenna distinguishes because that's what the Court of Appeals in the McKenna case, which is the fountainhead of all this technicality, distinguishes that employer's insurance case, which the predecessor, I think, is Article 2044 to Rule 118, where the constable was permitted to come in and amend his notice. Simple procedure, corrected. If it's necessary to say in the notice, which I think would be an overburden on the constables, and the rules 16, I think, and 107 of what they're supposed to do, just adding too many things, if they should say that they found that it was business hours when they were there, that's something that could easily have been amended if they had preserved the error of the trial court, like Rule 324.52 suggests. Then this would be a simple issue, and they wouldn't be here.
It could be amended, but the default would still stand.
Right. This employer's case,
amending doesn't help the defendant if he's complaining about a lack of notice, because it's just going to leave the default in place.
But the complaint here isn't lack of notice. And that's, you know, there are a lot of opportunities for the defendant to complain about lack of notice and raise it and not be subjected to jurisdiction if they didn't receive fair notice. Here they've admitted notice. And they're basically coming in and saying, if we hadn't admitted notice and we didn't have this fair notice, well, you couldn't approve it. Well, if they didn't have it, then we probably couldn't approve it. But that's not the point, and I submit that we shouldn't be here then.
Admittedly, notice is receiving notice is important, but is how you receive notice important? For example, I suppose you would not argue that handing the citation to a janitor at a very remote office would be the same as the service required.
Right, and that brings us to this point. That's constructive notice, where it's substituted service, and I submit that all the cases they submitted are cases that deal not with actual notice, but with 106 service.
Well, let's get something straight from a definitional standpoint. Can any business or any corporation be given actual notice as opposed to constructive notice? I mean, it's always my understanding that anytime you have an agent for service or anytime you're an entity, that's constructive notice. And then it's just a question of what it is. It's impossible to actually notice an insurance claim.
That is a difficult, esoteric question, and the same thing came to my mind. And I went to the books, and they And they didn't. I couldn't find that specifically addressed, but they contrasted actual notice and constructive notice in the law. It's pretty much been that way in Texas, too, with whether somebody was actually served personally.
But the somebody is the defendant. And when you have an agent for service, I don't care if your agent's sitting at the right there at the desk at the front office 24 hours a day, it seems to me, just for the terminology's sake, we ought to call that constructive notice.
It conflicts with what's already been defined as constructive notice, but I admit that, I mean, that's a question without an answer, and the federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, have all skated over that issue.
Well, you seem to be coming here wanting to solve a lot of problems, but I guess it's
that. Well, I think that you don't have to solve a lot of problems, but basically just hold to the cases. And I want to go to some of the cases to point out that this doesn't bring about a significant change in the jurisprudence of Texas. Basically, all it requires is a clarification of a case that's been misinterpreted, the McKenna case. But back to Judge Heck's question on the constructive notice, then the standard, sir, is whether or not the procedure that was followed is reasonably calculated to give notice. And that's not applicable here.
The statute says if you take it over there during business hours to the home office, that's reasonably calculable to give actual notice. And the question is that what happened in this case?
There's nothing to contradict that. And that isn't the issue. I mean, that's not a question. The only question is whether there was proof that a minute afternoon was business hours. As far as the actual notice, there isn't any real question.
And you're saying that that's immaterial. As long as we got actual notice, it doesn't matter what time you serve.
To an extent. I mean, there has to be some limit. I mean, just somebody meeting you at the bar and saying, hey, I sued you today, that's actual notice, but that doesn't have the official tenor of a citation. So in a strict sense, no, but practically, yes.
Suppose someone at the office were working late, and about 9 o'clock the process server showed up, rang the security bell, and the fellow came to the door, and he says, here, 9 p.m. at night.
That probably wouldn't be business hours, and our rules take care of that. It gives them the opportunity to quash service, to a motion for new trial, to raise the issue under 324 and Rule 52, to take that up to the Court of Appeals, to preserve the issue, and let the judge decide. That probably, maybe the judge could take judicial notice, that wasn't. But and the attorney,
I'm asking you to be the judge and tell me whether or not 9 o'clock at night is business hours.
I think that if I were the judge...
And why?
Yes, sir. The defendant complaining of default judgment should bring that forward.
That's a point of error.
As raised in the motion for new trial, what is the point of error? And then you
decide. You admit now that it is not necessary for a defendant in these circumstances to do anything in the trial court, is it?
Well,
if it appears on the face of the record, and so maybe they do here to try this issue of what time. But in the ordinary service case, if the error is on the face of the record, you can just go straight to the appellate court.
By a writ of error. But that isn't, we're not in that procedure. But see, this is a little different because on the face of the record, it was good on the registered agent. They brought it into question. That makes it a fact issue.
So they had to go to the trial court to try that question.
And even though they didn't preserve that, I concede that the judge considered it, okay, they prevailed on that. But then you don't hide behind the law. You consider half the issue and deny the other side the opportunity to bring in proof to show that the service is still recognized and that we accomplished it, even though we didn't.
You weren't thinking about this issue at that time, I guess.
Yes, I was, but I didn't think that it was a serious question of 1201. P.M. being, I meant to serve under this section. The constable put registered agent. I figured that's great, that's easier. But then there we get in. But the rule would have no effect if you make the constables do too much. I'm trying to remember. Justice Spears is coming. I think I pretty much answered it. Then they come into the trial court and you take evidence. If it's to be construed business hours for that company, as the appellate court did here, then you decide.
You can raise jurisdictional questions for the first time on appeal.
Right.
Why can't you raise this question for the first time on appeal?
the type of jurisdictional questions you raised for the first time on appeal are fundamental errors, if there is such a thing anymore. And those have pretty much been held to be subject matter jurisdiction questions, not the one I'm on. By writ of error, you can raise it on appeal. And I'm not saying I can't, but...
If you were willing to say this is something that any judge along the line could take judicial notice of, then it could be raised for the first time on appeal, which is... If you can't take judicial notice of it, and therefore you have to have testimony, then it has to be resolved by a hearing in the trial court under some denomination, whether that's motion for new trial, motion to set aside, whatever.
I'm I guess I want my paper number two, but I think it's clear enough that it could take judicial notice, but it's something that you create havoc if you start chipping away at Rules 52 and 324 that I think this court has been trying to
do. But you think it should clearly be their burden? Would you say you've got a waiver component of it?
Yes, and it's not just this case. There are a lot of opportunities for it. I mean, the restatement deals with this, and it says it's like there's no worthwhile interest of the party being served on a technicality here to claim this. They're saying that they should stand in the same foot as the person who didn't receive any notice. Somebody that never received notice, that because we haven't proved evidence that it was business hours, that they should stand in the same position as the person who was.
Shouldn't our presumption always be in favor of a trial, though?
Yes, in an ideal sense, but we've got this whole book of rules here, and we're faced as lawyers with the need of technicalities because the system would collapse if we did everything on a pure sense. And I would submit here that if you go back to that pure sense, fundamental fairness and justice on this issue, that they have many opportunities to raise this point, and they can, former Chief Justice Calvert in the McEwen case that's on the list there, he goes down through this analysis and basically says when there's no judgment, there are plenty of opportunities to raise it. I mean, no jurisdiction. But when there is jurisdiction, and somebody wants to question it, then they reasonably should have the burden of bringing it forward and letting the trial court, in fairness, decide it. It goes into the question of void and voidable issues, and I noticed I cite the Tidwell case because I see that Justice Ray, went on the Texarkana Court, has confronted this issue before. And that goes back into this McKenna case, which is off-cited for the proposition of strict technicality. But I submit to the court that in 1965, when that case was decided, that isn't what they were saying. That was a case where the predicate was not laid under a Rule 106 service. And they distinguished the decision of the Court of Appeal, which is the employer's case that's at 74 Southwest 2nd, 435, where the constable was permitted to come back in and amend the service. And they distinguished them. And they said, they're just considering in McKinnon the issue of whether the predicate was laid for the long-arm statute. They're not considering the issue of proof of service, which was the issue in employers at the Court of Appeals, and the issue that was employers, which was cited by the Court of Appeals on the case they were hearing. They specifically were not dealing with this. McKenna has been overused, and I would commend close reading of this employers case because it really presents the situation here, and when you look at what McKenna decided and how it contrasted Supreme Court's decision with that employer's case, it shows that the hyper-technicality, I'll submit that it's been followed under McKenna, does not have any foundation in substance in the McKenna case. Now, I'll point out one thing, the question of Judge Phillips, Chief Justice Phillips, on the technicality of preserving error. PPG case, I've cited this court, 82, found that where there was a subject matter jurisdiction question, that the error had to be preserved and the global error was never made. You've already started tackling that issue, and I would suggest that that case offers some evidence.
Thank you, counsel.
I would point out in my prayer...
Look, you'll have another opportunity. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Mr. J. Kevin Clark will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. Gentlemen, Mr. McBee, on behalf of his clients, is asking the Supreme Court of Texas to take a radical departure from the law as it has existed with regards to default judgments. It's important to remember that we're sitting here today having two insurance companies as defendants of the trial court without an opportunity to get their cause to be heard by a jury in Tarrant County. They have been denied the right to trial, and we need to determine today if that denial of the right to trial was correct. Specifically, did that trial court have jurisdiction to enter the default judgment against both insurance companies? I think it's also important to note that the old saying of bad facts make bad law is particularly applicable in this case, because one of the defendant insurance companies in this case didn't even write a policy of insurance for these people. So to the extent that this court would reach out and assist Mr. McBee in his proof at the trial court level on the default judgment.
You just say that. Did you try any credit standards, or did you try to set up a meritorious defense?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. Those were addressed at the trial court level. We attempted to set up a meritorious defense, and it was interesting to note that the trial court alleged as to the insurance company, which we'll call General Life and Accident, a meritorious defense was set up. He noted that as to national benefit, a meritorious defense was not set up. However, he elected to go ahead and enter the default and without even addressing that issue further. Yes, Your Honor, we did try to set up that defense. In essence, this is not hyper-technicality. When you're talking about jurisdiction of a person or jurisdiction of a corporation before the trial court level, Mr. McBee attempted to use 3.64 of the insurance code to serve these companies. As Chief Justice Phillips pointed out, service on a company is very difficult. A company can only act through its individuals, and the legislature told us in 3.64 you have to serve the president, the vice president, the registered agent, or serve it at the home office during business hours. Now, in the face of the record, it is not shown that this was served during business hours. Mr. McBee had notice of 3.64 when he attempted service. Proof of the fact that the insurance company was open at 12:01 p.m. for business hours would have eliminated this problem for him as far as jurisdictional concerns, and we would have never been here.
He could have amended, had the officer amend the return and put comma during regular business hours, and that would be... You'd be out then, right?
If he had proof that he had done that, yes, Your Honor.
But I mean, he could have come in with an amended return of citation.
Well, he probably could have, but let me point out that in the Dickinson case that he uses to support that authority, he tries to go through the play between Rule 16 and Rule 107. The court in that case allowed the constable to go back and amend that citation because they held that Rule 107 did not mandate a place of service. Therefore, they would presume that the constable served it within the county where he had jurisdiction and they allowed it. In this instance, though, 3.64 mandates a place and a time of service, and there is no proof on the record that either of those strict standards were met.
Now, I thought under Rule 118 you could always amend.
Oh, I'm not saying you can't amend, Judge, but I'm saying that the cases that support an amendment which would allow this type of situation to prevail and stand have only been cases where the underlying statute where you were trying to serve did not mandate whatever you were trying to make around. For instance, there's another case that he cites, and I don't remember the style right now, but the court was having problems because the summons used archaic language. It used the word summons rather than citation, and they said, well, we're not going to allow that. There was another case where a fellow named James Smith was served rather than Jim Smith, and those technical things were allowed to be amended. But there have been no cases where we allow the constable to come back in and amend a citation where there's a fundamental defect on the record.
You think it's fundamental that it said 1201?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think it is fundamental. I think it's fundamental because it's a jurisdictional problem. what we're entering in here...
Counsel, why didn't you raise it in the motion for new trial?
Judge Gonzales, it was raised in the motion for new trial, not specifically in the wording. There's not a sentence in there that says it was not served in normal business hours. But in the proof of motion for new trial, there were numerous complaints that Joyce Brown was not the registered agent. Is your question, why didn't you raise it exactly about the 1201?
Yes.
Your Honor, I can't answer that. I don't know.
I mean, if you put on evidence that the insurance company always closed between 12 and 1, and that was posted on the door, we wouldn't be here either.
That's true.
Or if the door were locked and they had to knock to gain admission.
That's true. So here we stand basically with a clean slate as far as evidence on 1201 is concerned. And when this court is confronted with that clean slate, we have to go back to McKenna versus Edgar and not indulge in any presumptions which would support a default judgment. I have no problem with indulging, and this court indulging with presumptions which support the affirmation of judgment after trial. But when somebody is being denied the right to trial by jury, we should not indulge in those presumptions. The worst case scenario is we go back to the trial court and we have this case heard. It's important to note, in one of the cases that's cited by Mr. McKinney in the supplemental list of authorities, I would point the court to the American Universal Insurance Company versus DB&B Inc. That case is out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals. That case went up to this court and was refused, no reversible error. That case is strikingly similar to this case. In that case, an insurance company was sued, which makes it a little different than the default judgment case. Yet the return of service indicated that the registered agent had not been served. The Corpus Christi court held in a 2-1 decision that because the face of the record did not show strict compliance with 3.64, there was no jurisdiction. What that case turned on was whether the judgment entered was void or voidable. And in a 2-1 decision, the Corpus Christi court said, a judgment entered by the trial court when it does not have jurisdiction is void. Now, there is a dissent to that opinion, and the dissent says that that judgment is not void, but rather voidable. However, the cases cited for that proposition don't really hold for what they're saying. I was bringing now to the issue of admission, whether by admitting you received notice, you have somehow waived the right to complain of jurisdiction. In every case cited by the appellant, it's the entire record that reflects the notice. There was, one, an admission of receipt, and secondly, an admission that whoever received it was either the individual who was being sued or was received it in the capacity for which the lawsuit was filed. So the entire record itself shows notice of the person who's involved in the controversy, and therefore the court held that that admission constitutes a waiver. It's not in this instance. It's not in the sense where a mere clerk got the notice or got the citation and filed a claims file. To that extent, the company had no notice that the citation had been delivered and therefore no opportunity to present their problems to the trial court. Additionally, this court has held before that issues of jurisdiction can be raised at the appellate court level. And if the court were to hold in this case that indeed there was some sort of waiver of the right to complain of personal jurisdiction at the trial court level because of these facts, it would be very difficult then to logically look at the right of a person who doesn't participate in trial to directly attack that judgment at the Court of Appeals by way of writ of error and complain for the first time of jurisdiction versus those people who come into court and don't bring up jurisdiction at that point, a judgment's entered, and yet the court later finds that jurisdiction didn't attach to that court.
Well, isn't it pretty simple, though? I mean, don't we have an existing rule that's pretty simple, which is if error's on the face of the record, you can come in by writ of error, or you can take an appeal without stopping by the trial court first to say how to do. And the appellate court can just look at the record and toss it back. But if it's something that takes explanation, like is Joyce Brown in fact the registered agent, or perhaps is 1201 normal business hours or not, because for some businesses it will be and for some businesses it's not, that you've got to stop by the trial court and get that issue resolved. And if you don't, you simply have a failure of proof in order to carry your burden of setting the judgment aside. Now, we don't indulge in any presumptions in favor of the judgment. But just if you merely come up and say, well, I have no proof, but I'd like this set aside, that, you know, that's not enough to set that judgment aside.
I believe I understand what you're saying, Judge, but I think that we're
and as far as this being void judgment, doesn't this Corpus Christi Court, if it, I have not read it, it says what you say, says, doesn't that go against just a long train of cases of this court going back to the 1930s about what is void and what's voidable?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does.
But that's aside, it's a technical, I guess. I mean, you have to presume that it's not void before you get to my hypothetical.
That's true.
Hypothetical.
All right.
Just assume with me that it's not, and you can go back to that issue.
All right. And specifically, Judge, I believe you're asking about, in a situation where the defendant did not put on any affirmative proof of 1201 not being business hours. Well, in that situation, once again, the record is blank. But we have to indulge in presumptions. I understand that the court would not like to indulge in presumptions to support either side, but we have to in this situation.
And isn't it your burden once the judgment's there?
On jurisdiction, Your Honor, I would argue the court that no, it's not. In other words, judicial economy, to the extent that we move cases to the court system in Texas, is a very good goal, but it's not a good goal to the extent that we rapidly move people through the court system and we enter judgments against them when in fact the court did not have the jurisdiction to begin with.
Aren't all the presumptions against default judgments embodied in these rules that make it very difficult to get a default, to uphold a default judgment? The presumptions just aren't looming out there. A default judgment's bad, let's set it aside. They're embodied in the writ of error concept and the concept of you don't have to file a motion for new trial and the Craddock standards.
Well, yes, Your Honor, they are. And they're, as you've said, they're both difficult to obtain. And once you obtain them, they're difficult to hold. But once again, we're sitting here as far as the proof is concerned on that one issue with which the legislature designated was an alternate means of service, and that being business hours. We've got two clean slates. We have absolutely no proof either way.
Then why shouldn't you lose?
Because if I lose, then you have indulged in a presumption which supports the default judgment. The one case which Mr. McBee cites as construing business hours at some point was a Puerto Rican case, which was a bankruptcy case that was trying to determine if businesses in Puerto Rico were usually open on Saturday. And the court determined after hearing the proof that yes, they were usually open on Saturday morning, but no, they were usually not open on Saturday afternoon. So even at that standard, it shows that whether or not business hours are applicable for any business is relative. And this court should not indulge in the presumption that business hours are business hours. We can go out to West Texas and the law office is...
We're not indulging on a presumption of business hours. We're indulging in a presumption that when a judgment is final, the appellant has to present some evidence that will cause us to set it aside.
And as far as personal jurisdiction is concerned, Your Honor, I don't see how this court can get around what would be construed as a presumption that the citation was delivered during business hours when the face of the record is blank as to whether 1201 was business hours.
Counsel, your adversary says that you have admitted that you received actual notice. Is that accurate?
No, Your Honor, we have not admitted that we received actual notice.
Do you dispute that you had actual notice?
Judge, we did dispute that we had actual notice. Joyce Brown received the citation. If you look at all the cases, once again, which I alluded to earlier, about an admission of receipt of citation and whether or not that should be construed as some sort of waiver of a right to later complain of a defect or a waiver of a right to complain of jurisdiction, every one of those cases embodies more than this case embodies. They embody the first, which is this defendant received the papers. But secondly, the record goes further in each of those cases to show that this defendant who received the papers was the person who should have received the papers. Now, the record is clear in this case that Joyce Brown was not the agent. So the person that received the papers from the first branch of that test is not the person who should have received the papers, since the actual notice of the lawsuit was not given. In fact, the proof at the trial court level was that the papers were just placed in the claim file, much like a medical bill would be, or a correspondence to the insured.
Does the proof show who placed it there?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
Does the proof show whether it was placed during regular business hours?
No, it's silent as to that also, Your Honor. It's important when you look at the actual notice given to a company that the legislature made it extremely easy to serve insurance companies. They said you can serve these, the three designated people, or you can just leave it at the home office during normal business hours.
We concede that that's actual, you don't buy the idea that no insurance company can get actual notice, that it's all constructed.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that when you're serving companies, it's all constructed notice, and therefore that's why we take great care to designate those individuals.
But then I guess when we talk about constructive notice, there's actual constructive notice and constructive notice. And there's something. I mean, you make a further division.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. And, you know, there's some cases that have come out of the Court of Appeals which sort of allude to even a higher standard, just as an aside, as a democratic test, almost a negligence standard. And those cases can all be distinguished because the individual served in those default judgment cases was the individual who knew there was a dispute going on. It wasn't the janitor working late at night, or the secretary at her desk. It was the individual who knew there was a dispute brewing.
Was this a receptionist that actually got the citation?
Yes, Your Honor. Joyce Brown is secretary of receptionist. It certainly was. And there was proof of that at the trial court level. I don't think that...
She was at the front door. I'm not familiar with the facts. Was she next to the front door that was unlocked?
Judge, I got a little problem because I know the situation in the office, and I'm trying to remember if that was actually proven at the trial. That's where she is, but I don't know if that's in the record as far as where she actually is. I certainly don't. I think that as we go back, we must look at this case and realize that the burden is on the plaintiff to prove that he has served the defendants. So you don't have a situation where we have an insurance company that didn't even write a contract of insurance and yet has been sued for $160,000 and a judgment has been entered for $160,000 against this defendant. That's the reason why we have the strict rules of service, and we assure ourselves that the person who is charged with responsibility to serve or receive a citation, or the person who actually knows that the dispute is brewing, should be the person to serve. And failing that, and failing affirmative proof on the record that that's what occurred, this court should not indulge in any presumptions. They should not take judicial notice at 12:01 p.m. in business hours, but should rather send this case back to the trial court for a full trial.
Who did Joyce Brown actually work for?
Joyce Brown, Your Honor, once again, the evidence, I believe, is either silent as to that, or it will show that she is a common employee
of both of the companies.
Yes, Your Honor. There are common employees of both of the companies. However, that doesn't, you know, get us over the hurdle that General Life didn't even issue an insurance company, nor receive any premiums, of course, from the plans, nor would they be liable for any medical benefit, and yet they're thrown in the same hopper. And I think that's important in this case, and that's why I started out my argument with bad facts make bad law. Because in this instance, when you look at the way the citations were served, and they were served together, it would be virtually impossible to do justice and yet split one out from the other. Either service was right, and therefore National Benefit should have a default judgment held against them, even though there was no affirmative proof on the record, or service was wrong, and therefore both cases should go back to the trial court for a trial before a jury. I'll yield the rest of my time back to the court unless there are questions, and just ask the court not to indulge in any presumptions as they haven't since McKenna versus Edgar in favor of this default. And hyper-technicality, when you're talking about personal jurisdiction and rendering judgments and whether that person is subject to the jurisdiction of the courts of the state of Texas, I don't believe should be fairly labeled as hyper-technicality, but really a recognition of due process. I might mention one other thing. The Kawasaki case was cited in the appellant's brief, mentioning that failure to file a motion to quash somehow constitutes waiver. All of his cases regarding the actions of the trial court as far as jurisdiction are concerned, none of those are default judgment cases. The case that I mentioned in the supplemental brief, it's important to note that in American Universal, a motion for new trial was filed, and jurisdiction was not raised in that motion for new trial. This is the case under Corpus Christi. But the Kawasaki case, or any of the cases that say that the defendant should come in with some other motion, some other vehicle to complain of jurisdiction, that case doesn't apply. That, of course,
we're talking about long-arm jurisdiction.
That was long-arm jurisdiction, and you were talking about the scope of a 128 hearing, and that really doesn't apply. There are some broad statements in the appellant's brief and in citations, but they don't deal with this force of a different color that we're dealing with today, and that is the default judgment situation. I yield the rest of my time back to the floor.
Questions? Thank you, counsel.
Please court.
I would suggest two or three things here that cloud the issue. The first is whether this one insurance company ever issued a policy of insurance. And that's an emotional issue, and it's not really before the court. But since it's been raised, I'll address it. We concede that that's a meritorious defense, but we do not concede that. The denial of coverage, and this is in the record, was made by that insurance company. All of the people that testified, this Joyce Brown is the common company. Much of the correspondence about whether they would pay this claim or not were from the insurance company that claims they didn't write a policy of insurance. That's
we're really not up here on that.
That's right. I mean, I just want to make that clear, and that so that the court's not swayed by that, you know, that grave injustice. That's something that could be, because for the trial court, the Craddock test has been addressed, and we're not here on Craddock either.
They lost it up down there, so
we're not here on Craddock either. Now, the key kept coming back to the fact that you have to be real strict when you're determining whether or not there's judgment. Whether there's jurisdiction.
Hasn't the Supreme Court kind of taught us that in the last year?
It says follow due process, not go by the technicality of, and for often, by the technicality of meritorious defense when there has not been due process. And what I'm saying is, due process is a good standard, one that's been through the test of time in the federal courts, and really here too, and that's what should be followed. And what does due process require? That there's all the cases, jurisdiction of the person, territorial jurisdiction, and notice. That's all due process requires. And we have, one doesn't apply because they were suing their home county. The other one, they have actual notice, admitted that they got the process.
Now, even if we were to agree with you on your basic argument, I don't think we could agree, could we, that actual notice of a lawsuit is good enough to confer jurisdiction?
No, that's the example I made with Justice Ray. Tell them got in the bar that you serve them, they're suing them today. No.
Yeah.
And that is addressed in the restatement that there has to be some formality.
I just want you to stay within that line and just...
Yeah, the end of the citation and the petition. That's what takes that over the line. Actual notice and that formality gets you over the line.
And the other thing that we have is in due process our having rules that we follow to determine what would constitute sufficient notice and what isn't.
Right, and this court could say that this proof has to be in the record. I mean, that so due process doesn't...
Let me string you out. So you'll agree with me this is a voidable and not void judgment?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that has been addressed in this McEwen case.
I think that was settled in McEwen, or in McKenna, actually. But if I'm wrong...
I think it's McEwen.
That being the case, we look at the return of citation to determine whether or not there has been service. And under Rule 118, the court had, and if this return of citation had put in it, served at 12:01 during normal business hours, then you'd win, no question about it. Unless the defendant had come in and gotten a hearing and proved that wrong at the trial court.
Right.
Unless the defendant had done that. It doesn't. Rule 118 says those things can be freely amended, or they can be amended at the trial court's discretion.
Yes, sir.
You never tried to amend the return.
There was no notice. There's any question about it.
Okay. But we're up here. What you're opposing to that is a blank slate either way. I mean, we don't know about 12:01 p.m. on this insurance company in Fort Worth, Texas.
I submit that the trial court made a finding of fact. Now, he didn't outline the evidence that he based on it, but he made a finding of fact.
Is that a finding filed?
A finding filed that they were served at their home office during business hours. That's in his findings of fact. And that's another thing to put him on notice, to raise it so that it can be cleaned up. And we've gotten an affidavit from the constable. That's something that could have easily been.
You had an affidavit from the constable? Or you say you could have?
No, we have one. It's
was it filed?
No, it's not filed. It's an amendment in the in the brief.
It cannot be, if it's filed after the trial court has the hearing, it's irrelevant. The cases are pretty clear on that, aren't they?
I understand. And that's the same as their brief was raised the constitutional issue itself. But what this goes to...
But I mean, why don't we put the burden on this finding that we'll have to look at that. In the absence of a finding by the trial court, at that, but why isn't the burden very properly placed on you if that return does not strictly show that it complies in all regards with Texas law, then you lose. Because of the lack of any presumptions given to a default judgment.
It's for you, this court, to define what's Texas law. I think it strictly complies with due process. They had notice.
A more liberal standard for granting default judgments would meet federal constitutional standards.
Right.
But if we have standards that we've set up, then it seems like both the state and federal constitution would require us to follow those standards.
That's why I asked you to read the McKenna case and the employers, because I don't think this court has really set up that standard. There have only been two cases. There's a couple of 85 cases, Browning and Uvalde, for this court, as I can find. I was going to say you've never cited McKenna. But the 285 cases, Brown and Uvalde, I have the sites here somewhere, where you did. But never has the court, this court, ever really held to that. Once you've got the jurisdiction, once you've met the due process, you have jurisdiction, then you're talking about the technicalities of service. And we've gotten muddled here about, well, can you ever have service on a corporation? Is that constructive or constructive? That's another issue, and this court has wrestled with long-arm service and substitute service over the years, and that's a tough issue, but basically has come down with once the agent or whoever is with the corporation, that's the same. That's why it's been called in the restatement and other places actual service. That's been construed as being the same as serving.
Personal and substituted are both actual service. That's one way of putting it.
No, they're substituted. Yes and no. It's
another rabbit trap.
Mr. McBee, let me ask you.
Yes.
Question. Assuming we agree with your position, this case would go back to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals can determine whether or not the aquatic standards have been satisfied or not. Is that correct?
Yes.
Because
I would submit that they're so clear that you all could decide if they brought it up here, but I don't know that I'm on very sound foot there. But yes, they still have that protection.
Because Court of Appeals never reached those points.
Or Court of Appeals never reached those points. And I was starting to say on the prayer, I don't want it, my prayer and the amended brief suggested to just, for this court to just render, I would go back to my prayer and the writ of error suggesting render or remand to the trial court or Court of Appeals as is appropriate. I wouldn't want to be held to that. Another thing that was raised was, read this American Universal case. I suggest that it's wrong. That's the case that McEwen is analyzed in the dissent and Justice Ray's Tidwell case on the void question. And I think that about whether or not the error has to be preserved. I agree with Judge Phillips. I think the voidable issue has been decided in that universal American Universal out of Corpus Christi, which is wrong. Now, the other thing is presumption. There is no presumption, really, that the court is being asked to indulge in. Findings of fact that the trial court was that he had jurisdiction because service was in the home office during business hours. I agree that for as far as jurisprudence is concerned, it should not presume that there's jurisdiction over someone unless the requirements of due process have been met. They offer the opportunity, as we pointed out before, motion to squash, motion to appearance, motion to trial and default, appeal, direct appeal, writ of error, and bill of review. There are many, many avenues. The Socratic test is very many avenues for defendants to protect themselves. It does not do this.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.